Welcome back, folks, to HBA Conversations and Connections. A special thank you to this year's sponsor, Ogilvy Health. When healthcare impact is your goal, let Ogilvy Health be your partner. I'm your host, Nicole Robinson, and today our guest's illustrious career and contributions to the life sciences sector are nothing short of extraordinary. Brigitte Nollet, President and CEO of Roche Canada Pharma, leads a diverse team of nearly 2,000 employees at Roche's Canadian pharmaceutical headquarters. Under her visionary leadership, Roche Canada has grown into a cross-functional hub and a leader within Roche's global network. Brigitte proudly considers herself a tri-sector leader and has always been at the forefront of policy, innovation, and excellence. Beyond her role at Roche, she maintains an external focus with key communities. She was elected as chair of the board of directors of Innovative Medicines Canada in 2023. She is a board member of Biotech Canada and Life Sciences Ontario, and is also a member of the Healthcare Businesswomen's Association's Partner Advisory Board. Today, we are thrilled to celebrate Brigitte's latest accolade, the Healthcare Businesswomen's Association Luminary Award. This award recognizes senior-level women who serve as role models, actively mentor and support others, and exhibit dedication to the healthcare industry. In this episode, we explore unexpected lessons from Brigitte's career journey, encouraging more women to pursue leadership roles in pharmaceuticals, the importance of mentorship in advancing careers, and predictions for breakthroughs in the future of healthcare. Brigitte's extensive experience and thought leadership offer invaluable perspectives on the evolving pharmaceutical landscape and the future of healthcare. Before we dive in, a special thank you to Ogilvy Health for sponsoring this year's podcast. When healthcare impact is your goal, let Ogilvy Health be your partner. Brigitte, welcome. Let's get going. Let's get started. Good morning, everyone. There is no better way for us to kick off our day and our week with Brigitte Nollet. We are lucky enough to have Brigitte here today. Thanks so much for making the time to connect with us today. And, you know, with overflowing calendars, we really appreciate you carving out the time for HBA, and we are just thrilled to have you here.
Well, it's my pleasure, Nicole, to be with you, and thank you for the invitation.
Well, as I have shared and alluded to, I have been a fangirl for some time of you, and you have been on my bucket list for a while, right up there with Michelle Obama and Oprah.
Oh,
so
my
no pressure
goodness.
Today. Right?
Oh, my
no
goodness.
Pressure.
It's early Monday morning. My goodness.
But I'm super pumped for this conversation, and I'm going to really try to keep my unbridled enthusiasm and excitement in check so that I can meet this moment and have great memories from it. So, look, we met a couple of years ago at an HBA event in Roche's Laval office, where you were speaking on advancing leadership and health equity. And I even have the selfie to prove it. You were so kind to me and humored me. From then, I have been following you ever since, and I have learned so much from watching you online and in conversations, or watching you in conversations at conferences and presentations. And look, I really admire your work. I am generally inspired by your action. And with two decades of leadership experience, to say that you are accomplished is an egregious understatement. You are a champion of women's leadership and development. You are a life sciences sector crusader. You are pioneering access to innovation to ensure patients get what they need. And what I love most about you is your authenticity. You seem to be the real deal. And I'm really looking forward to getting to learn more about you this morning.
Oh, thank you, Nicole. It's a good thing that cameras are off because you won't be able to see all the blushing that's taking place at the moment.
Well deserved, well deserved. So, recently, I was listening to a really brilliant LinkedIn Live conversation with you and one of your former colleagues, your Roche colleagues, Funke Abimbola.
Yeah.
And you were talking about how you are intentional about your career.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been with Roche for nearly two decades, which is a bit rare in today's job market. What has kept you engaged and motivated to grow within the same organization for so long?
Yeah. First of all, Funke is amazing. And so if people have a chance to really get to know her and follow her, she's just a really inspiring person. And what she's accomplished in her career is equally inspiring in my point of view. And to really get to your question, Nicole, I mean, I think, You know, there are a couple of areas that are important to me in my career and in the work that I do. And to be fair, you're right. It's 19 years with the company, but seven different roles in that 19 years that I reflected on. So a real opportunity that I've had over the years to keep growing and keep developing as a person. And that's been a really important part of how I stay motivated is the need to keep learning, the need for impact to continue, and where is it that I can make the best impact in that moment in time. And so I've just been really lucky that the company has supported me through my career, through different roles, through different opportunities, seven roles, four countries, and back in Canada now for 3 years. I'd also add, Nicole, which we have talked about in previous sessions, for all of us who work in the life sciences sector, it really is about the purpose of our work as well. Mm-hmm. I do feel that all of us who work in this sector have a drive to ensure that patients in whatever country we're working in, that patients have access to the medicines they need when they need them. And that for all of us is such a deeply meaningful piece of work. And it motivates us every morning when we get up. And so that's also one of those reasons that I stay and that I'm so passionate about the work that I do. It's also because I am a patient and I've been managing a chronic disease since my early 20s. And so the purpose of the work coupled with the inspiration and the ability to keep growing and developing. And then I think for all of us, and certainly for me at Roche, it's also the people that I get to work with, right? So I get to work with extremely thoughtful, passionate, knowledgeable, dedicated people. And so when you bring all that together, the purpose-driven mission, the prioritization around growth and development, and you couple it with excellent people that I get to work with around the globe, that's what keeps me here and that's what keeps me growing.
I love that. One thing I've heard you say before is intentionality. You have intentionality of those who you surround yourself with. And so I love that, you know, in Roche, you've surrounded yourself with people who, and externally as well,
for sure,
who help drive you and drive that purpose, that why. I love purpose. I show up every day as well with meaning, and purpose really helps drive direction forward. So
absolutely.
Love that. So you have worked in government policy, and now you lead one of the largest pharmaceutical companies in Canada. What's been the most important lesson that you would say that you've learned from your career journey?
Yeah, I've been very fortunate. I would describe myself, Nicole, as a tri-sector leader, somebody who's worked in the not-for-profit sector, in the public sector, and in the private sector. And I really think that is an important combination of leadership experiences to be able to see the healthcare sector from all these different perspectives. And for me, a key learning in my career has been to never underestimate the power of partnership and the power of collaboration. And, you know, we work in, healthcare is not easy. Healthcare is complicated. It doesn't matter the country, by the way. In every country I've worked in, healthcare is complicated. It's fascinating. It's important. And it's complicated to the extent that there's not one part of the industry, there's not one person, there's not one company, there's not one government agency that's going to be able to answer all of the challenges and be able to meet all of the opportunities. And it really is about bringing different people together with different perspectives and different strengths that can advance all around the same vision and common purpose, right? Really coming together as a team or as an ecosystem and understanding what is it that we want to achieve together, what are the outcomes we're seeking, and even though we're going to come at it from different perspectives, how can we put our different ideas on the table and see if we can't advance? And that's been one of the most important lessons to your question that I've learned over time. And whether it was when I was in the public sector and working on the extension of parental benefits back in 1997 through 2000, or whether it was when I was working with the trade association back in the early 2000s, looking at data exclusivity regulation, whether it was in my global roles where we were working with the Union for International Cancer Control around the City Cancer Challenge and trying to bring cancer solutions to cities for low and middle income countries around the world. It's always been, what is it that we want to achieve together? What can all of us do together? And how do we build that work? And, you know, at Roche Canada, one of the things, one of the examples I'm most proud of is also how we continue to think about moving beyond medicines and diagnostics and really being a partner in the entire ecosystem to bring those solutions forward. And last year, we announced a partnership with Horizon Health, the Horizon Health Network in New Brunswick, to deliver cancer immunotherapy treatment to lung cancer patients through a simple injection in their home. And so we know, those of us who may have some familiarity with New Brunswick, what I learned through my conversations is that people typically have to travel quite a distance to come to an urban center, an urban cancer center. And what was important in our conversations with the leaders in Horizon Health Network was, how could we think about treatment delivery differently so that we were both understanding the importance of oncology treatments and doing it differently, but also understanding the priorities they have around rural care and their rural agenda and policy agendas that they have. And was there a way to think about IV infusion that can typically take up to an hour? So you've got an hour plus you've got your hours of travel, taking time off work, finding carers for your families, where we could think about it differently, bring it into the home, allow people to stay home, and then understand whether that brings better outcomes, not only for the person, but also for their family. Does it make better overall health outcomes? How does it work for providers? Does it take stress off the system as a whole? And so that's one of the things that we're studying. And we got to that place because we had those conversations all together to understand, how could we think differently about healthcare delivery? How could we think differently about cancer care, knowing what our government partners and what our hospital partners and what our patients are going through in a world after lockdowns? Could we just think differently? And the answer is yes, we can if we all want to. And so it's just a really nice example of all of us working together. And it's a real lesson for me in every single role in the 19 years that I've had. Well, actually, the 30 years that I've had working, quite frankly.
Well, it sounds, you know, so having lived in New Brunswick and working in healthcare in New Brunswick and now working in oncology, it really sounds like you have your team has a clear understanding of rural environments and really driving change forward in terms of innovative solutions for patients. And I love that you said caregivers and their families as well, because as a caregiver of someone living, experiencing cancer, it is very meaningful that you think about the whole group involved, in addition to, and most importantly, the patient, right? Yeah. When I was hearing you speak about I've noticed you reference tri-sector leadership regularly, and I really do think that that is a unique experience among senior leaders in Canada, in our sector. And I think that that helps you rise to the challenge of really being primed and able, and well, obviously able, but capable of helping really make big things happen. And so that's why I follow you, because I think you and your team are going to really help shape some big changes in Canada. And lastly, I love the partnership and collaboration piece. I'm a bit of a collaboration queen as well. So I love that.
It's also part of our secret sauce a little bit in Canada, isn't it? That, you know, we're able to bring all sorts of diverse perspectives together around a table and really be solution oriented and find solutions to the challenges we have. And for me, it's just been such a, you know, having been born and raised and grown my early professional years in Canada before going abroad, it is something that I took with me into other roles. And I do think it is one of the strengths that we have as Canadians and as professionals in our different companies in the life sciences sector, is that, you know, everyone that I meet, the 100,000 of us that work in the life sciences sector across this country, we are all really always thinking about, how can I be a thoughtful voice, a thoughtful partner in this challenge moving forward. And so, yes, you're right. It's tri-sector leadership, not everyone has it. And I'm fortunate to have that different perspective. And I think the collaboration element that you raised is one that we all have in us as Canadians. And I do think it is one of the strengths. When I don't know about you, Nicole, when I have colleagues that come from different countries to visit, or that come and work with us from different countries for their own development purposes over time, it is always one of the things that they're most struck with when they come. It's just the openness that we have for conversation and solution building across the different sectors in Canada.
Well, we're going to switch sort of pace or tone for a second. Let's talk about your background, because I think this was really interesting. You have a background, including a degree in English rhetoric, which in itself is fascinating to me. And I didn't Google it, but I will, as well as women's studies. And I'm curious to know, how has that shaped your approach to leadership?
Yeah, I have a background in it's English rhetoric and professional writing. I also have an honors in social development studies from the School of Social Work, and then a minor in women's studies. And I only explain that because leadership really is about people, and it's about how you can communicate and connect with people. Mm-hmm. And I think that having a background that's both a communications background and a social work background has really shaped my leadership. Because at the end of the day, the work that we do, it is about working with people. Even the tri-sector leadership conversation we just had, it's about working with people. It's about having a deep fascination for people, curiosity about people, wanting to help grow people to meet their best selves. And, you know, it's that deep curiosity for who we are and how we can work together. So the social work side, the social development studies side, is a big part of what I keep with me when I go into any leadership role. And I think over time, right, with communications having evolved so much over the past 30 years since I studied, you know, thinking about this medium even that we're using today, or the speed at which information is exchanged, the importance of being able to communicate clearly, internally or externally, to be able to communicate clearly a vision, how one wants to be able to approach their work, how one wants to be able to collaborate with others. It's really important. And it's important to be able to cut through the noise, because there's so mm-hmm. much information that's coming at us all the time. So, you know, to your question, I do think the blend of curiosity for people and ability to communicate clearly are part of the elements that have helped form my leadership over time.
Ooh. Great answer. You know, I have heard you talk about how coaching and inspiring is instrumental to creating hope for advancement. And what do you think needs to change to encourage more women to pursue leadership roles within the pharmaceutical and healthcare industries?
It's a fascinating area, isn't it? It's a fascinating question, because research shows us that even though women make up 70% of the global healthcare workforce, we only make up 25% of health and social mm-hmm. care leadership positions. And so how do we think about that? And how do we really work as leaders and as company leaders and as a sector together in Canada to create an inclusive environment where everyone, all of our employees, can be successful and they can balance the demands of work and their personal life together in order to keep growing as leaders? And, you know, I think about this question in the context of Roche Canada. And, you know, we're very lucky at Roche Canada. We have a large proportion of our workforce, just over 60%, that's women in Roche Canada, of the 2,000 of us that are here in Canada. And it's very equitable across the different leadership positions, all levels of the company. And what's seized us in the past years and in the years to come is that sense of inclusion and that sense of belonging. And how can we do that in a way where all of our employees have that ability to continue to grow? Because that's one of the key areas. How do we help support all of our talent to be able to move into leadership roles in the future? And some of the things that we spend time on, as you mentioned, Nicole, and it is part of the strength of the Healthcare Business Women's Association, is to be able to offer opportunities to learn, opportunities to grow, opportunities to be inclusive. I love how the HBA brings women and men together to be able to talk about the challenges that we have, to be certain that all of our talent's able to grow thoughtfully through our sector. And I know for us, a big part of it has been, how do we create supportive, flexible working environments and policies that help all of our talent be able to move? Balancing work and balancing your personal life isn't easy. I know it. I'm a working mom. It's not an easy thing to do, and it hasn't been an easy thing to do over time. And so coming out of lockdowns in particular, I know we've spent an awful lot of time as a site leadership team for our global site in Toronto for Roche Canada, just thinking about how can we help people with a flexible work environment so that they are in office, but they're also able to have flexibility to work from home when required. How do we think about our transportation strategy, knowing that commuting is a challenge for new parents or anyone who's trying to manage personal and work life? And how can we think about transportation differently? So we've thought about carpooling, bus services, train services, 407, all of these elements together in our transportation strategy. We've thought a lot about parental leave and how can we ensure that young women and young men in our organization are able to take advantage of parental leave and be able to spend time with their family while, you know, their work waits for them. And I think one of the most important elements is also, how do we think about leave for those who are in that sandwich generation, who are caring for different family members at different ages, not just young children, but also their parents or their spouses who might fall ill? And how do we create those opportunities to really be able to have that good balance that's required? And if we can give those opportunities, to your point, Nicole, then we can see people start to flourish in their roles and we see them be able to continue to grow in their leadership positions, and they don't have to leave it behind in order to manage family situations alone. So, you know, that's the way that I think we can all continue to think about how we can see the really strong leadership connections take shape into the future. Is how do we work together? HBA is an organization that's bringing us all together, women and men, but also just creating those really thoughtful, inclusive environments where everybody feels they can belong. Everybody understands that there are support systems for them to be able to manage their family life, their personal life, their work life. And then I have to say, the other piece for us as executives is just staying open and constantly asking questions. You know, that concept of reverse mentorship, how can I continue to learn and understand what different generations of employees are looking for? It's the first time that I lead an organization with all generations being in the same workforce. And so I just find it fascinating to understand the different perspectives, the different needs, and they are different, and how we can create that most open and inclusive work environment.
You know what, you're saying, as I'm listening to you speak and you're saying, I guess I didn't think about it like that way, that you are leading a group of multi-generations. I had not, and as somebody who has studied sociology and loves and is, you know, intrigued by people and their behavior, that I'm sure that's unique in itself. Leading so many different groups.
It's been really interesting. It's been really interesting, Nicole. I myself also have that interest in sociology, but, you know, different elements are important to different people. So when you're early in career, you want to have discussions about how to gain as much work experience early in your career, how to change roles and do different projects, and what skills are required, and how do I grow my competencies? And those are really important conversations. And then as you move through your life and you know, move through different generations, then parental leave is going to become more important. I want to have a family. What does that look like? How can I talk that through? How does my job, you know, going to be impacted? How does my career get impacted? What can I do to continue to be, a thoughtful member of this workforce in the future? And then, you know, for us, as you go through, maybe when you come to my part of the generation, then we have policies around financial planning and opportunities around financial planning, because that becomes really important in life. And you're caring for, you know, older kids or older parents, and you're really thinking about, you know, what is it that I can do to really set up the last part of my career in the best way possible? And so it's just been really wonderful. And it's probably my biggest stretch, Nicole, in this role that I've had over the past 3 years, is working and being a representative of a global site here in Canada, but also working with all these generations and getting to learn what's important.
Well, look, I am part of your generation, so I get it, sister. I know, I know what you're saying. It's so interesting to me because I feel like your group is and your team is really creating an inclusive environment. Okay, so I have heard, I've heard you talk a lot about female empowerment, women's leadership and growth. I have been so fortunate, and I know where I work, there are so many impressive and incredible leaders. I've been fortunate to work with and alongside folks who know how to get things done and who do it in their own way. And that can be different than what, what we have traditionally seen. And so my question to you is how can you women leaders shift the narrative around emotional leadership and leverage it to lead differently?
Yeah. And you referenced it a little bit at the outset, the concept of authenticity, right? And it's difficult as a leader over time to find your authentic voice and to find your way to lead in a way that represents who you are and who you want to be. And that leverages the strengths that you have. And you are right. I've learned over time the importance of empathy, the importance of authenticity. It's a big part of the leadership considerations we have as a global company. And, all of us have different trainings and different leadership trainings that our companies offer. And for us, a real focus on authentic leadership, empathetic leadership, thoughtful leadership, creative leadership. These are elements that have very much been important elements of that Roche philosophy towards leadership. But it's also really been a part of how I've been able to evolve as a leader. And when I think about all of us, it really is trying to be our whole selves, right? We just had that discussion on inclusion. We want to be able to bring and balance our personal lives and our professional lives. And we want people to be high performing. We want everybody to be able to succeed in the work that they want to accomplish. And you do that when you're able to be your authentic self. And I suppose, Nicole, we were talking about generations of leaders and, in the generation that I'm in and what I've been able to learn over time, women have been labeled when we get very emotional about issues, when we think about empathy, when we think about authenticity, it can get labeled at times. And I think what I've learned over, the 25 plus years that I've had working is that it's actually my empathy that is my strength. It's my ability to learn. It's my ability to be open-minded, to be leading with kindness, with fairness, with empathy, but always having high standards for the work around me, always wanting to strive for that next best concept and innovation. And it's finding that balance. And to be fair to you, Nicole, I had a session that you've just made me remember with some colleagues a few years ago. My GM colleague in the French affiliate brought me forward to speak to some talent in the French affiliate. And, the conversation he and I had is actually that empathetic leadership is not just about women having empathetic leadership. It's actually about all leaders, men and women, understanding, particularly coming out of our experience in the pandemic, the importance of being empathetic and thoughtful and balancing the strive for high performance organization with that empathetic approach. And, he and I talked through things like in COVID, we were all going through such uncertain times, right? It was really important for all of us to create a safe space for employees. I was the one working and approving a mental health hotline for employees. I was doing weekly coffee chats for anybody who wanted to dial in and talk through the challenges they were seeing, creating a safe space for employees to cry. And of course, there were some that needed that emotional release because they were losing loved ones, or they weren't able to visit loved ones in long-term care facilities, or they were taking care of their families at home while one of their spouses was a healthcare professional and was in hospital risking their own life, So there was so much happening during those lockdowns, and I think we all learned about the importance of really combining empathy and authenticity and inclusivity all together to bring out the best in our people and to bring out the best in humanity in that moment in time. And I think I've just learned to embrace it, and to be really proud of it and to understand that this is who I am. And when I think about what we're looking for in our leaders now, we are looking for that balance. We're not looking for the top-down leadership anymore. We're looking for leaders who can help bring the best out of us, who are thoughtful and empathetic, and who challenge us and inspire us to bring the best possible work we can bring. So I don't know if that gets to the full answer that you're looking for, Nicole, but that's certainly part of what I've learned. And I still have a lot of work life ahead of me and years of work ahead of me. And I will continue to learn.
It answers it perfectly. From now. I think some of my takeaways recently as I enter my new milestone of the world this year.
That's fair.
In my generation is it's okay to be, you know, to be vulnerable. I think it takes courage to be vulnerable. So I think that lines up with what you're talking about. So if you were, what is one habit or routine that you have helped, you know, you felt that have helped as you're so seasoned in your career, you know, to keep you grounded and to stay balanced in such a, you know, in such a demanding role, because you're a mom and you've got a busy career and there are moms out there listening to you for sure. And I'm sure they're curious as to how do you do this?
I'm giggling because the first thing that came to mind was exactly that. I'm a mom of two teenage girls. And so I stay grounded because the minute I go home, I am just a mom of two teenage girls. And, you know, they keep you humble and they give you feedback and you understand, you know, that you can do all of this impressive work in the professional setting, and when you come home, you have to be available to your children, to your family. You know, it's about understanding what pressures and balances they have and trying to be available. And teenagers, Nicole, I don't know about you, it's the first time I'm a mom of teenagers, and you know, it's not that they want you there every moment of the day, but when they want you, you have to be there. And so, you know, it's about yeah, if there's anything that keeps me grounded, it's understanding how to help them navigate some of the conversations and some of the decision making and some of the pressures that they're facing. And I really do try to be home, you know, by the end of day Thursday, if I'm traveling, to really be home, really be there on weekends, really be available for the conversations that are necessary.
I'm looking forward to being more in your end of the teenage years. And one thing I love that I've heard you say before is you've said, I also love surprising you with these quotes, by the way. You probably think I'm a stalker, but I'm not a stalker, I promise. I just very well researched. You said something, and I actually wrote this down and put it on my wall so that I can see it. You said, you wake up every morning and you're a mom first and foremost, and then you make your way to the office. I thought that was brilliant. I don't know if you remember saying that, but you did, and it's great.
Oh, but it sounds absolutely right and absolutely true, right? You get out of bed, you go down those stairs, and they are there, and they need, you know, that support and that consideration. And that's absolutely true. And that is, you know, that's my number one responsibility, is making sure that I raise two kind, brave, courageous, thoughtful, intelligent. You know, they're so kind and they're so smart. And when you get into these teen years, Nicole, and they start having opinions on topics and they're willing to sit down with you and challenge perspectives and ask you curious questions about your own perspectives, it's just so fulfilling as a parent to see them develop into their own person.
There's some impressive work being done to drive change for Canadians. And we often hear about the challenges in bringing new medicines to market. What's something people might not realize about this process?
Yeah, it's a really important question. And you are right. I'm very passionate about this topic. And we're passionate about it at Roche, but we're also very passionate about it as an industry. And I am the chair of the board of Innovative Medicines Canada, and it's a big area of focus for us as a board as well. How can we think through and work constructively to help support faster and more thoughtful and more timely access to innovative medicines here in Canada? I think maybe to start with your question, what's important for us to realize is that it's a really a significant investment of time and resources go into producing just one successful new medicine, right? When we think about our global trade association, the IFPMA, they will often explain that only one or two out of every 10,000 compounds that are studied in a lab actually make it successfully to patients. And so when you think about that, and you think about the fact that it takes, again, approximately 10 to 15 years to develop a new medicine, with an average of about $2.6 billion US dollars in developing that medicine. I mean, these are eye-opening, outstanding numbers, right? They really make you pause and think. And then when I think about that global perspective, but then bring it to Canada, what is really important is how do you bring those medicines then that make it through all those challenges? How do we then in a country make that available to the person who can actually benefit from it? And what I found most interesting, Nicole, having spent 9 years abroad and then coming back to Canada 3 years ago, what was really eye-opening for me was actually how long it was taking. So not only does it take that long, you know, 10 to 15 years to develop a medicine, but then you have to go through the thoughtful and the important regulatory and reimbursement environments of your country to be sure that that medicine makes it to the patient. And so when I think about Canada, it takes an average of 2 years after a medicine receives its Health Canada approval for safety and efficacy to be able to make it through to Canadians through their drug, their public medicine plan, right? Their public drug plan. And yet in peer countries, it takes about half that time. And so how do we really think about how we can bring the time that it takes for Canadians to have access to medicines down? And how do we make it closer to peer country timeframes? And one of the big learnings that I've had in this process is actually that we all want the same thing, Nicole. There is no one you're going to meet in a government agency, in an academic setting, in a hospital setting, in a patient group setting, in our life sciences sector that wants it to take a long time. We all want it to be thoughtful and efficient. The question is just how can we do that in a way that meets all of the different needs that are important in the system? And how can we go from a sequential process, because it takes a long time, because there's a lot of red tape, and because it is a sequential process. You have to finish one step in order to move to the next step, in order to move to the next step. And in a federation like Canada, how do we work together to think about concurrent processes, to think about ways that we might be able to do things differently to offer the care and to be able to move through the system so that we can meet that timeliness that we all want to see. And so I think that's one of the most interesting, or perhaps it's an area that people don't realize in the process, is that it takes a year longer in Canada than it does in Western European countries to have access to the same medicines with the same data. And we have a system in Canada that's quite sequential in nature. So how do we think differently?
You've been deeply involved in healthcare policy in, you know, many of your years of working. Where do you see immediate opportunities to advance healthcare in Canada?
Yeah, there's an element of speed and timeliness that's important. It's from a healthcare perspective, but it's also from an economic perspective right now. And I think it is important for all of us to recognize that our governments are grappling with really complex healthcare challenges. I mean, you just look at the aging population, you look at health workforce constraints, you look at the growing burden of chronic diseases, you look at the fascinating speed at which we are developing medicines, and the wonderful science that's coming. And then you have to think about layering on what you've just mentioned, which is the economic challenges that, at least we'll speak to Canada, that we're currently facing. And, you know, in all of that challenge, Nicole, is actually where I see the greatest opportunity. And it's an opportunity for all of us in the life sciences sector and for all of us that are working in public and private and not-for-profit sectors to actually come together and understand how we could advance healthcare. And in advancing healthcare, we will grow the life sciences sector. And when we grow the life sciences sector, we are then benefiting our healthcare systems. We're benefiting Canadians with stronger employment, and we're benefiting our economy. And so how do we start to have that conversation in a way where we understand that investing in healthcare is investing in our economy? And when we think about what it is we do as a collective, Nicole, again, I referenced 100,000 employees earlier. It was a StatsCan report that came out in 2021, and it talked about the fact that as a sector, we invest about, $3 billion wow. in R&D. We're 102,000 employees across the country, and our economic activity then spurs about $16 billion worth of economic investment in the country. And that's us in 2021. Imagine if we advance that into today's world and we said to ourselves as a collective of not-for-profit, public and private sectors, if we said to ourselves, what if we leaned in to the life sciences sector and said to ourselves, what proactive measures could we put into place that would help grow this sector? And what areas could we, what uncertainty are we creating in the system that we could stop doing? And by being proactive and then really creating certainty, or at least, you know, stability in the life sciences sector, how could we help spark this sector to grow even more? Because that 102,000 jobs is being done without a set of coordinated life sciences sector strategies that are coming together across the country, right? We work in individual provincial and territorial settings where everybody has their individual plans, but we don't yet have a way to work collectively across the country to really think about the areas that if we could be more proactive in, we would help shape and advance and grow the economic impact that the life sciences sector can have at a time that's really crucial for our country. And we'd be able to do it in a way that is also helping our healthcare systems evolve and nurture. And here, Nicole, I'm thinking of things like, how do we work together on clinical trials, research and investment? How do we streamline processes so that we can make decisions together across provinces? Do we really need to do research ethics board reviews in every single hospital? Or can we follow the CIHR work that's being undertaken right now to think about how to streamline this across the country? And if we could do so with clinical trials, we would see massive improvements and investments because Canada has really strong clinical trial outputs. Where we lack is in the speed and the ability to be able to coordinate it and get it up and running quickly across the country. Same could be said for health data infrastructure, right? The secondary use of health data. We have European Commission movements on health data because we know if we had strong, interconnected, accessible, interoperable data, we'd be able to make speedier and more thoughtful decisions. And yet we're still faxing things among each other in certain hospital networks. Like, how does that work? And then the concept of Canada being well positioned to ensure that there's timely access to new medicines. And that can happen with Health Canada thinking through rolling submissions that are available for all submissions, like we're seeing in the European Medicines Agency or in the UK review process. We can look at things like mutual recognition agreements and international recognition of decision making. And, you know, we can think about our reimbursement processes and how we can make them, as I said before, more concurrent. And what I want to say, Nicole, is I don't want to give your listeners the impression there isn't work being done, because I'm actually really impressed over the past year with how much movement we have seen. We have seen the Canada Drug Agency come forward with initiatives like Target Zero and really think about concurrent work between Health Canada and the Health Technology Assessment Decision, and how, when the Health Canada decision is made, can there be a Health Technology Assessment Decision made at the same time? So how could that improve and continue to work? And that's been a really important change in the process. We've seen both INES and the Canada Drug Agency think through societal perspectives in submissions, right? We talked about it earlier with Horizon Health. It isn't just the medicine and the trial endpoints that are important in every medicine. A medicine can also offset costs in other part of a healthcare system. How do we measure that? How do we talk about that in a way where we understand the importance and how a medicine might offset caregiver burden, how it might increase productivity levels, how it might meet the rural policy agenda of a government, and what does that value look like? And so we're starting to see those conversations take place. We saw the Council of the Federation late last year. So these are the premiers that lead the Council of the Federation. They came forward in December and they committed together to wanting to really think through how we could work and pilot a new process to speed up access to certain oncology medicines by 9 months. And, you know, these are all important signals. Of course, we'd love it to be all medicines, and we really think we can be working together constructively with provincial and territorial and federal governments to really be proactive on these fronts. And I think these are all really important steps in the right direction. I think, to your point, in an ever-changing geopolitical environment, the question becomes, how do we do this faster? We need to be stronger altogether. We need to be bolder in our ambition. It's time to be disruptive. It's not time to do things as we've always done them and to follow the status quo. The life sciences sector can be a stronger player in the economy. It can be a stronger player in our healthcare systems. It can be a stronger advocate and support system for patient access to medicines. How do we decide to do this all together, public sector, not-for-profit sector, private sector together? Because it's going to take all of us talking to each other, working in lockstep.
You know, challenge often provides opportunity, and it's such an exciting top sciences sector in Canada. And for all those reasons you just outlined, and, you know, I always am continuously energized by the work that has been done, as you pointed out. I guess it begs the question, I regularly reflect on this and think, you know, because everything is evolving, including the pharmaceutical industry, it seems to be in perpetual motion. Can you predict one big, you know, big idea or big healthcare breakthrough that you think we'll see in the next 10 years?
Do you know what? I'm not sure I'm predicting anything, but what I think is really fascinating and really important in the next 3 to 5, let alone 10, you know, is the importance and the convergence that we're seeing right now in how science and technology are meeting. Our ability to develop science and to discover new medicines is going to be flourishing with the advent of technology, be it artificial intelligence, be it better health data systems, machine learning. Computational biology is real and it's important, and it is how medicines are now and will be discovered going into the future more and more. And that's the exciting part, Nicole. Science is progressing at a speed we could never have imagined a few years ago. Like, I still remember being at university and getting my first email address and walking to the computer science labs because I didn't have a computer and I didn't have internet in my dorm room and having to log in, right? And now we're talking about computational biology. We're talking about gene and cell therapy. We're talking about gene editing. We're talking about genomic profiling. We're talking about how we use real-world evidence to inform care decisions. And that's just a few things. And when I go back to the previous conversation we just had about Canada's potential, when you think about things like artificial intelligence, this is actually an area of huge potential for Canada. We are a leader, a global leader in this space. And so how do we continue to move forward and develop the ecosystems, develop the policies, develop the regulations that will help us harness this strength? Because it's not something that you just automatically have and you will always have. Technology is moving quickly and we all have to move with it. And if we want to be the leaders in AI now and into the future, then we have to be able to invest in the areas that are important. I know for us, for example, as a company, we recently announced a partnership with the Ontario government where we will be bringing up to 250 informatics roles to Canada. And that's to expand our knowledge, our global knowledge of AI, our ability to think through machine learning, to think through computational biology, and to think through our informatics capabilities, because that is how our research is evolving and changing. And I'm sure we're not the only company that is thinking this through. And so how do we, when I think about Montreal, Toronto, Alberta, and the different AI centers we have, we're building ecosystems where drug discovery is taking place with AI. And so I think the key for us, Nicole, is how in the next 3 to 5 years do we harness that strength that we have and make it a real global superpower of Canada's life sciences sector? And how do we ensure that all of our policies, our reimbursement processes, our processes for safety and efficacy review, how does every adoption in hospitals, understanding of how this work and these new medicines will come forward, how do we make sure that our healthcare systems in Canada are ready?
Brigitte, thank you for making the time, and go forth and prosper. Our HBA community wishes you great success and patience. We are cheering you on with patients and caregivers and allied healthcare. And so go after the goal. We wish you only success.
Thank you, Nicole. Thank you very much for the opportunity today. It's been a really fun conversation. I appreciate it very much. And thank you to all your listeners as well. It's not just about me moving forward. It's about all of us moving forward together.
Agreed. Power and partnership and collaboration.
Absolutely. Thank you.
There's some impressive work being done to drive change for Canadians. And yeah, we often hear about the challenges in bringing new medicines to market. What's something people might not realize about this process?
Yeah, it's a really important question. And you are right. I'm very passionate about this topic. And we're passionate about it at Roche, but we're also very passionate about it as an industry. And I am the chair of the board of Innovative Medicines Canada, and it's a big area of focus for us as a board as well. How can we think through and work constructively to help support faster and more thoughtful and more timely access to innovative medicines here in Canada? I think maybe to start with your question, what's important for us to realize is that it's a really significant investment of time and resources go into producing just one successful new medicine, right? When we think about our Global Trade Association, the IFPMA, they will often explain that only one or two out of every 10,000 compounds that are studied in a lab actually make it successfully to patients. And so when you think about that, and you think about the fact that it takes, again, approximately 10 to 15 years to develop a new medicine with an average of about $2.6 billion US dollars in developing that medicine. I mean, these are eye-opening, outstanding numbers, right? They really make you pause and think. And then when I think about that global perspective, but then bring it to Canada, what is really important is how do you bring those medicines then that make it through all those challenges? How do we then in a country make that available to the person who can actually benefit from it? And what I found most interesting, Nicole, having spent 9 years abroad and then coming back to Canada 3 years ago, what was really eye-opening for me was actually how long it was taking. So not only does it take that long, you know, 10 to 15 years to develop a medicine, but then you have to go through the thoughtful and the important regulatory and reimbursement environments of your country to be sure that that medicine makes it to the patient. And so when I think about Canada, it takes an average of 2 years after a medicine receives its Health Canada approval for safety and efficacy to be able to make it through to Canadians through their drug, their public medicine plan, right? Their public drug plan. And yet in peer countries, it takes about half that time. And so how do we really think about how we can bring the time that it takes for Canadians to have access to medicines down? And how do we make it closer to peer country timeframes? And one of the big learnings that I've had in this process is actually that we all want the same thing, Nicole. There is no one you're going to meet in a government agency, in an academic setting, in a hospital setting, in a patient group setting, in our life sciences sector that wants it to take a long time. We all want it to be thoughtful and efficient. The question is just how can we do that in a way that meets all of the different needs that are important in the system? And how can we go from a sequential process, because it takes a long time, because there's a lot of red tape, and because it is a sequential process. You have to finish one step in order to move to the next step, in order to move to the next step. And in a federation like Canada, how do we work together to think about concurrent processes, to think about ways that we might be able to do things differently to offer the care and to be able to move through the system so that we can meet that timeliness that we all want to see. And so I think that's one of the most interesting, or perhaps it's an area that people don't realize in the process, is that it takes a year longer in Canada than it does in Western European countries to have access to the same medicines with the same data. And we have a system in Canada that's quite sequential in nature. So how do we think differently?
Sure. So I look at, I think about, especially these environment is changing so rapidly. And you've been deeply involved in healthcare policy in, you know, many of your years of working. Where do you see immediate opportunities to advance healthcare in Canada?
Yeah, there's an element of speed and timeliness that's important. It's from a healthcare perspective, but it's also from an economic perspective right now. And I think it is important for all of us to recognize that our governments are grappling with really complex healthcare challenges. I mean, you just look at the aging population, you look at health workforce constraints, you look at the growing burden of chronic diseases, you look at the fascinating speed at which we are developing medicines, and the wonderful science that's coming. And then you have to think about layering on what you've just mentioned, which is the economic challenges that, at least we'll speak to Canada, that we're currently facing. And, you know, in all of that challenge, Nicole, is actually where I see the greatest opportunity. And it's an opportunity for all of us in the life sciences sector and for all of us that are working in public and private and not-for-profit sectors to actually come together and understand how we could advance healthcare. And in advancing healthcare, we will grow the life sciences sector. And when we grow the life sciences sector, we are then benefiting our healthcare systems. We're benefiting Canadians with stronger employment, and we're benefiting our economy. And so how do we start to have that conversation in a way where we understand that investing in healthcare is investing in our economy? And when we think about what it is we do as a collective, Nicole, again, I referenced 100,000 employees earlier. It was a StatsCan report that came out in 2021, and it talked about the fact that as a sector, we invest about, $3 billion wow. in R&D. We're 102,000 employees across the country, and our economic activity then spurs about $16 billion worth of economic investment in the country. And that's us That's us in 2021. Imagine if we advance that into today's world and we said to ourselves as a collective of not-for-profit public and private sectors, if we said to ourselves, what if we leaned in to the life sciences sector and said to ourselves, what proactive measures could we put into place that would help grow this sector? And what areas could we, what uncertainty are we creating in the system that we could stop doing? And by being proactive and then really creating certainty, or at least, you know, stability in the life sciences sector, how could we help spark this sector to grow even more? Because that 102,000 jobs is being done without a set of coordinated life sciences sector strategies that are coming together across the country, right? We work in individual provincial and territorial settings where everybody has their individual plans, but we don't yet have a way to work collectively across the country to really think about the areas that if we could be more proactive in, we would help shape and advance and grow the economic impact that the life sciences sector can have at a time that's really crucial for our country. And we'd be able to do it in a way that is also helping our healthcare systems evolve and nurture. And here, Nicole, I'm thinking of things like, how do we work together on clinical trials, research and investment? How do we streamline processes so that we can make decisions together across provinces? Do we really need to do research ethics board reviews in every single hospital? Or can we follow the CIHR work that's being undertaken right now to think about how to streamline this across the country? And if we could do so with clinical trials, we would see massive improvements and investments because Canada has really strong clinical trial outputs. Where we lack is in the speed and the ability to be able to coordinate it and get it up and running quickly across the country. Same could be said for health data infrastructure, right? The secondary use of health data. We have European Commission movements on health data because we know if we had strong, interconnected, accessible, interoperable data, we'd be able to make speedier and more thoughtful decisions. And yet we're still faxing things among each other in certain hospital networks. Like, how does that work? And then to your last point, the concept of Canada being well positioned to ensure that there's timely access to new medicines. And that can happen with Health Canada thinking through rolling submissions that are available for all submissions, like we're seeing in the European Medicines Agency or in the UK review process. We can look at things like mutual recognition agreements and international recognition of decision making. And, you know, we can think about our reimbursement processes and how we can make them, as I said before, more concurrent. And what I want to say, Nicole, is I don't want to give your listeners the impression there isn't work being done, because I'm actually really impressed over the past year with how much movement we have seen. We have seen the Canada Drug Agency come forward with initiatives like Target Zero and really think about concurrent work between Health Canada and the Health Technology Assessment Decision, and how, when the Health Canada decision is made, can there be a Health Technology Assessment Decision made at the same time? So how could that improve and continue to work? And that's been a really important change in the process. We've seen both INESS and the Canada Drug Agency think through societal perspectives in submissions, right? We talked about it earlier with Horizon Health. It isn't just the medicine and the trial endpoints that are important in every medicine. A medicine can also offset costs in other part of a healthcare system. How do we measure that? How do we talk about that in a way where we understand the importance and how a medicine might offset caregiver burden, how it might increase productivity levels, how it might meet the rural policy agenda of a government? And what does that value look like? And so we're starting to see those conversations take place. We saw the Council of the Federation late last year. So these are the premiers that lead the Council of the Federation. They came forward in December and they committed together to wanting to really think through how we could work and pilot a new process to speed up access to certain oncology medicines by 9 months. And, you know, these are all important signals. Of course, we'd love it to be all medicines, and we really think we can be working together constructively with provincial and territorial and federal governments to really be proactive on these fronts. And I think these are all really important steps in the right direction. I think, to your point, in an ever-changing geopolitical environment, the question becomes, how do we do this faster? We need to be stronger all together. We need to be bolder in our ambition. It's time to be disruptive. It's not time to do things as we've always done them and to follow the status quo. The life sciences sector can be a stronger player in the economy. It can be a stronger player in our healthcare systems. It can be a stronger advocate and support system for patient access to medicines. How do we decide to do this all together? Public sector, not-for-profit sector, private sector together, because it's going to take all of us talking to each other, working in lockstep.
You know, challenge often provides opportunity, and it's such an exciting time sciences sector in Canada. And for all those reasons you just outlined, and you know, I always am continuously energized by the work that has been done, as you pointed out. I guess it begs the question. I regularly reflect on this and think, you know, because everything is evolving, including the pharmaceutical industry, it seems to be in perpetual motion. Can you predict one big, you know, big idea or big healthcare breakthrough that you think we'll see in the next 10 years?
You know what? I'm not sure I'm predicting anything, but what I think is really fascinating and really important in the next 3 to 5, let alone 10, you know, is the importance and the convergence that we're seeing right now in how science and technology are meeting. Our ability to develop science and to discover new medicines is going to be flourishing with the advent of technology, be it artificial intelligence, be it better health data systems, machine learning. Computational biology is real and it's important, and it is how medicines are now and will be discovered going into the future more and more. And that's the exciting part, Nicole. Science is progressing at a speed we could never have imagined a few years ago. Like, I still remember being at university and getting my first email address and walking to the computer science labs because I didn't have a computer and I didn't have internet in my dorm room and having to log in, right? And now we're talking about computational biology. We're talking about gene and cell therapy. We're talking about gene editing. We're talking about genomic profiling. We're talking about how we use real-world evidence to inform care decisions. And that's just a few things. And when I go back to the previous conversation we just had about Canada's potential, when you think about things like artificial intelligence, this is actually an area of huge potential for Canada. We are a leader, a global leader in this space. And so how do we continue to move forward and develop the ecosystems, develop the policies, develop the regulations that will help us harness this strength? Because it's not something that you just automatically have and you will always have. Technology is moving quickly and we all have to move with it. And if we want to be the leaders in AI now and into the future, then we have to be able to invest in the areas that are important. I know for us, for example, as a company, we recently announced a partnership with the Ontario government where we will be bringing up to 250 informatics roles to Canada. And that's to expand our knowledge, our global knowledge of AI, our ability to think through machine learning, to think through computational biology, and to think through our informatics capabilities, because that is how our research is evolving and changing. And I'm sure we're not the only company that is thinking this through. And so how do we, when I think about Montreal, Toronto, Alberta, and the different AI centers we have, we're building ecosystems where drug discovery is taking place with AI. And so I think the key for us, Nicole, is how in the next 3 to 5 years do we harness that strength that we have and make it a real global superpower of Canada's life sciences sector? And how do we ensure that all of our policies, our reimbursement processes, our processes for safety and efficacy review, how does every adoption in hospitals, understanding of how this work and these new medicines will come forward, how do we make sure that our healthcare systems in Canada are ready?
I always learn from you, and I'm sure that our listeners will definitely appreciate and your insights that you shared today. So, Brigitte, thank you for making the time, and Go forth and prosper. Our HBA community wishes you great success and patience. We are cheering you on with patients and caregivers and allied healthcare. And so go after the goal. We wish you only success.
Thank you, Nicole. Thank you very much for the opportunity today. It's been a really fun conversation. I appreciate it very much. And thank you to all your listeners as well. It's not just about me moving forward. It's about all of us moving forward together.